Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
All of us who consume oil come to that region to plunder its petroleum, and this is going to arouse hostility.
Energy and security policy expert Michael T. Clare is our guest for the half hour. He's five college professor of the Peace and World Security Studies program at Hampshire College in Amherst and defense correspondent for The Nation magazine. Michael Clare's most recent book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. Clare is also author of Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum. Professor Clare, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi.
First, to what extent does the quest for oil influence U.S. foreign policy?
I think that American foreign policy in general has been shaped by the pursuit of oil since the end of World War II. I think that oil has been a dominant feature in the making of American foreign policy. So this is not a new factor. It stems from the fact that the United States is the world's leading consumer of oil. We have an economy that's highly dependent on oil, and we were once the world's leading producer of oil. That was true up until the 1950s, but starting in 1970, when U.S. oil production peaked and began an irreversible decline, we've become increasingly reliant on imported petroleum, much of which has to come from the Middle East, from Africa and Latin America, areas that are inherently unstable. American foreign policy has been largely shaped by the need to ensure our ability to procure oil from those dangerous areas. And that's led to a series of alliances with dictators and kings and sheiks and whatever in those parts of the world. And that has been, I believe, a dominant factor in American foreign policy going back to FDR, but increasingly so from the 1970s to the present.
Now, I know you've been concerned about America's dependence on foreign oil for some time. What about Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin and her argument that we can replace that dependency with oil from Alaska? What's your position on that?
Well, there's no way that Alaska can replace foreign oil. That's a joke. There simply isn't the oil there to satisfy America's need. We'd have to reduce our oil consumption by 95%. And go back to the Stone Age, and then Alaska could provide us with enough oil. So that's a joke. She does talk about natural gas, and there is some natural gas in Alaska, and we could use that, and maybe that would provide us with 10% of our needs. So this is a deception being perpetrated by the Republican Party. There is some offshore oil and gas, probably in the offshore Atlantic and the Pacific of the United States, and this could provide another 2 or 3% of our needs. So this is all for ideological purposes. The fact is that the United States relies on imported oil for 2/3 of our consumption, and nobody, Republicans, Democrats, has any idea about how to replace that. Fact is, there is no way to replace that. We have to go to other sources of energy entirely before we can replace our need for imported oil.
Now, there's been discussion of offshore drilling in the Arctic in waters where some five countries, including Russia, Canada, the U.S., Norway, Denmark, have said they also have exploration and drilling rights, a battle going on. Tomorrow morning, starting at 8 a.m., we're going to be discussing these claims during a two-hour Talk Nation Radio special. But what about this hidden battle over resources that keeps going on perpetually in the background, and most Americans know nothing about it?
Yes, and I think actually this is something people are becoming more and more interested in, and there certainly is oil, but more natural gas than oil in the Arctic region. Most of it is in territory controlled by Russia for the simple reason that Russia has more of a coastline on the Arctic than any other country. Probably after that, Canada and Denmark, because Denmark owns Greenland, and Greenland has a large Arctic coastline. There is a lot of promise up there, but the promise grows greater the hotter the planet becomes, and the hotter the planet becomes, the more catastrophic the effects we can expect from global warming. Specifically, more intense and dangerous hurricanes, reminding us that global warming may make the Arctic accessible to oil and gas drilling, but its consequences for the rest of the planet are likely to far outweigh any benefits of Arctic drilling.
Experts at the University of Alaska that we'll be hearing from in the morning were quite concerned with the potential loss of fish in the Arctic. This is a huge industry, provides a lot of the world's food resources. What about the environmental disaster of another potential Exxon Valdez type event and all of this food that we would lose?
Drilling in the Arctic only becomes practical the warmer that the oceans become and the planet becomes, and we will be dealing with environmental catastrophes on such a large scale that the world's economy will be totally devoted to reconstruction in the wake of these devastations. We're not going to have the money for drilling in the Arctic at that point anyway. So this is all fantasy life.
What are some of the world's hot spots that you're looking at where the quest for resources could prompt more violence or even war in the coming years?
In my new book called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy, I focus on the three areas of the world where you have competition between the major powers, that is, between the U.S., Russia, and China. And I concentrate on those areas, which are Africa, Central Asia, and the Caspian Sea, and the Middle East. I concentrate on those areas because that's where the great powers are in contention. The title of my new book, I think, is meant to illustrate what I see as the most dangerous reality we face today, which is that we have not only the United States and Europe and Japan, the old industrial powers, competing for resources, but now we face the rise of China, India, and other developing countries which have an appetite for resources equal to our own. At the same time, the planetary supply of resources is shrinking, so we have a double whammy. Rising demand and shrinking supply happening simultaneously, and the competition, I think, is going to become increasingly intense and volatile. And that volatile situation will be felt, I argue, in most concentrated form in Africa, the Middle East, and in Central Asia and the Caspian. I believe the recent fighting in Georgia and in the Caucasus is an expression of this. This was fighting between the U.S. and Russia, but it's against the backdrop of a larger three-way struggle between U.S., Russia, and China for the resources of the Caspian Sea. Georgia is a energy corridor, so-called, for the export of Caspian Sea oil and natural gas to Europe. That's what the fighting was about.
In Blood and Oil, you point out how former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and others used a period when they were in exile from power during the Clinton years to devise plans for an expanded U.S. military establishment. And then they implemented those plans when they got back into power. Are there teams that have formed to dominate the world's resources? And, you know, regardless of what party is in the White House, we're essentially dealing with the same people. And if so, what can Americans do about that?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough question. Well, of course, the most visible figure in all of this is Dick Cheney, the vice president, who, as we all know, was the CEO of Halliburton, an oil services company. Of course, the whole Bush administration is permeated with people from that universe. And Dick Cheney has been the most visible figure in promoting America's geopolitical interests in this competition I'm talking about between the U.S., Russia, and China, especially in Central Asia and the Caspian Sea. He's been frequently in the Caspian region visiting Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, Georgia, seeking to counter Russian efforts to gain control over the flow of Caspian Sea energy. And he was in Azerbaijan and Georgia last week, arguing for a greater Euro-U.S. joint effort to counter Russian influence in the region and beef up NATO's military presence in the region to protect the flow of energy. So he's the person who's been most visibly identified with these U.S. efforts, but many others have as well. And I think I should make very clear, this is not just a Republican Party effort. The Democrats have been deeply involved in this as well. It was President Clinton who first proposed turning Georgia into an energy corridor for the flow of Caspian Sea energy, oil and gas, through Georgia to the west. And he turned Georgia into a military protectorate of the United States. He was a big backer of this, and Al Gore was deeply involved in these efforts as well. Al Gore was his representative to the Caspian Sea countries in promoting Caspian Sea energy for all of his talk of global warming and such. So this is a bipartisan policy effort for a very long time.
A lot of Americans that have been following politics over the last 7 years seem kind of despondent about the current economic and political crises. How can we gear up to reclaim democracy, wage peace? What kinds of things can we do regardless of which candidate wins in November?
Well, I think that, you know, that Americans clearly understand today that this history of oil addiction and oil dependency has to be eliminated. We can say this because both presidential candidates speak of the need for energy independence, of breaking our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. Now, their remedies for this differ sharply. Senator McCain's solution is to drill in offshore areas, more nuclear power, more coal, steps that I think will not actually improve our overall energy situation in the long run. Senator Obama would put much more emphasis on conservation and on the development of energy alternatives. But we have to go beyond all of that and move towards a new energy paradigm altogether that would involve much more public transportation, for example. So there's a lot that needs to be done, and I think Americans understand we have to move radically towards a new energy system. All Americans understand that. There's a lot of debate about the best way to move forward. So this is a matter both of personal choices, what kind of vehicle we drive, when we drive, how we heat our homes, and almost everybody I talk to is making choices, personal choices, family choices, to conserve their use of energy. But it's also a political choice, a community choice. What are we doing in our communities to improve public transit, to heat our schools and public buildings with solar energy, and so on? So it's a family effort, it's a community effort, it's a national effort.
Do you think the Bush Doctrine, the use of America's military preemptively as supposedly a defensive measure, would continue under a new administration of either McCain or Obama? I mean, Governor Palin not apparently knowing much about this.
Both Barack Obama and John McCain say they will use military force when necessary to protect vital, fundamental American interests. They both begin from that premise, and let's agree that we don't know what any of them will do when push comes to shove. So then we're left with rhetoric, and there's no question in my mind that John McCain uses far more saber-rattling kind of rhetoric than Barack Obama does. Barack Obama stresses that before we use force, we have to exhaust every form of diplomacy we possibly can. And John McCain seems to be very impatient with diplomacy. So as a professor of peace and world security studies myself, I prefer to hear somebody talking about using diplomacy before we go off to war, and Barack Obama reassures me on that point.
Now, the U.S. has sent U.S. naval forces and other kinds of troops to various parts of the world. Is this an indication that the Bush White House, the Cheney White House, are setting up a situation where if John McCain is elected, you can see a clear direction that the policy will likely go in because of the people that will stay in power, because of the various forces within the Republican Party as opposed to the Democratic Party?
This is something that's a little bit hard for anyone to gauge at this point, to be perfectly honest. Both candidates have been unrevealing of their intentions with respect to military policy. Both candidates say they will expand the U.S. military. The one thing that we know for sure is that Barack Obama has said that he will draw down U.S. forces in Iraq once taking office, but he has said he will increase U.S. presence in Afghanistan. And this will require maintaining a large military infrastructure in the Persian Gulf area. So it's very hard to tell exactly what will happen. The big difference that I see is that John McCain seems to be much more militant in his response to Russia than Barack Obama. Barack Obama has said very little about the threat posed by Russia, whereas John McCain seems to view Russia as if it's the reincarnation of the Soviet Union at the heyday of the Cold War, when Russia posed a much greater military threat than it does today. And he talks about reviving NATO to the peak of its Cold War strength. This is very different from Barack Obama, and it worries me a great deal because the U.S. military today is in no condition to mount a major military offensive aimed at Russia. We would need a vast expansion of the U.S. military to continue to conduct military operations in the Middle East and to begin the new containment of Russia again. This is very worrisome.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. The BBC's Newsnight recently interviewed U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq. They found soldiers who felt abandoned, mistreated, and abused by White House policy.
Well, it's my third time in Iraq, and first time I was here, I thought it was the right decision. Second time, I was like, all right, well, maybe they need some more people to come over here since they chose us again. Third time, it's just a waste of time now. It's too much money, too many lives lost, too many families destroyed, like mine. I miss my family more than anything.
All right, my name is Specialist Holly, and I'm sitting here to share my views on the war in Iraq. All right, first off, I'd like to say that a person can be loyal to his country without being loyal to the people who run his country. I have faith in my chain of command and my leaders, but basically I think we're in a stupid, pointless war because a lot of politicians either A, can't admit that they were wrong, or B, are making a lot of money off of this war.
We're speaking with Professor Michael Clare about world energy resources as a driving force behind U.S. policy initiatives like the Iraq War. You write in Blood and Oil on page 139 in your discussion of no safe havens. You've sort of looked at the war on terror, you've looked at resources in the Mideast, and also you're writing about the stands here in this portion of your book and temporary bases established in Kyrgyzstan and Khanabad in Uzbekistan.
Yes.
Supporting American combat operations in Afghanistan. And then you write, quote, "One thing is certain, The Caspian harbors a witch's brew of unresolved rivalries and disputes, and Washington might easily view any full-scale war in the region as a severe enough threat to the nation's interests to justify the use of military force and the sacrifice of American lives. We've heard U.S. soldiers now very low in morale, they've suffered greatly. They're starting to look at this with anger as if, you know, they're not in Iraq for the right reasons. Could Afghanistan look like that soon? And what about this issue that we might see U.S. forces entering wars, maybe even world war, if we see sort of civil wars cropping up around, and if we see the kind of problems you're talking about that have to do with existing struggles in these parts of the world where we're now seeing our interests?
Indeed, you're right to ask this question, and part of my answer is to remind listeners that the U.S. has really four military forces. We have an army, we have a Marine Corps, we have a Navy, and we have an Air Force. And most of the disgruntlement we hear from the military and the weariness is coming from the army, which is bearing the brunt of the battle in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to some degree from the Marine Corps, which is also overstretched, because they're the boots on the ground, as they say. They're the ones that patrol the streets of Baghdad and Kabul and other cities and face the roadside explosives and the snipers and bear the costs of war on an everyday basis. And they're the forces that are the least likely to look forward to more ground conflicts in the Middle East or the surrounding area. And they're going to say no if asked to any more such conflicts. But that's not necessarily true of the Navy and the Air Force, which haven't been exposed to the same kind of wear and tear and don't have boots on the ground every day in Baghdad and Kabul and other such cities. And I think don't feel the same degree of resentment. And I think might feel very differently about the expansion of conflicts, you know, an attack on Iran using air and naval strength or sending the Navy into the Black Sea, which appears likely in kind of show the flag missions to threaten Russia, more air missions. We've seen in Afghanistan an increasing reliance on air power with resulting civilian casualties. I think this is where things are headed. Remember, John McCain was a Navy pilot. I think you're going to see less reliance on the Army and the Marine Corps and troops on the ground and much more reliance on air and naval power, which doesn't bear the same risk. And this, too, is deeply worrying because of the risk of what's called collateral damage of civilians being killed, like we've seen in Afghanistan.
And we've seen, too, that the U.S. has done a lot of propaganda around the idea of winning hearts and minds, but then in practical terms doesn't seem to do much of that abroad. I mean, we don't see these big humanitarian efforts even after a U.S. bombing run. So how do U.S. forces, how does the Russian military, too, get around the problem that the human beings in these areas of the world where corporations are looking at resources are going to become increasingly angry and hostile? And we're going to see, you know, continued terrorism, obviously, because when people feel hopeless and they can see a clear enemy, which in this case would be the U.S., but it could also be other forces. I mean, in Afghanistan, the Russians were once the big enemy.
Yeah, this is a good point, Dory. And I think that's an inevitable curse attached to our addiction to oil, that two-thirds of the world's oil is found in the Middle East. Another tenth is in Africa, and I might point out that a lot of that oil is in countries that are Islamic countries, Algeria, Libya, Sudan, Nigeria, which has a large Muslim population, and another large portion is in Islamic countries in the former Soviet Union. Something like three-quarters of the world's remaining oil is in Muslim countries. And there's no way that you could separate that reality from the politics of the Islamic world. We are seen, that is, the West is seen in our addiction to oil as plundering the riches of the Islamic world, or at least that's the way it is viewed by, and polling data confirms this, by many, many people in the Middle East, that that's why we're there. And anything we say about democracy, about human rights, about modernization, all of that is viewed as icing on the cake or as propaganda. We're there for their oil, and because of that, we make friends with dictators and kings like the royal family of Saudi Arabia. And the Russians did that too during the Soviet era. So you're right about that. All of us who consume oil come to that region to plunder its petroleum, and this is going to arouse hostility, and the militants and the zealots like Osama bin Laden are going to exploit that reality for their own benefit and their own evil purposes. That is the origin of 9/11. And I tried to show that in the movie Made of Blood and Oil. You could see a trailer for the movie at www.bloodandoilmovie.com if people are interested.
Which of the U.S. presidential candidates do you think would be more likely to offer hope to societies living near energy resources that they would be factored into U.S. foreign policy plans?
If I were living abroad and looking at the presidential campaign and reading their speeches, I would be much more inclined to favor Barack Obama because he speaks of healing the rift that has developed between the United States and its allies by being more prone to listen to our allies, to include them in the conversation, of being less arrogant, less unilateralist, whereas John McCain continues to talk about American leadership, that we have to lead the world, you know, and the rest of the world will follow. And that's not what the rest of the world wants to hear. So it's not surprising to me that polling data shows that people, especially in Europe, prefer Obama to be elected. That's going on the basis of what they say.
And Senator Biden, do you think he has more ability to look out for foreign societies?
I'm only going by their record. I think Senator Biden is a very experienced foreign policy player, and obviously his counterpart, Governor Palin, has no foreign policy experience.
Is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you about?
We didn't talk about China very much, but I do think that in the years ahead, the most important reality we're going to have to face is the rise of China as a major energy consumer. If the U.S. continues to compete with China for what's left of the world's energy supplies, and we do this in an antagonistic fashion, what they call a zero-sum game, we compete aggressively and we use military means in that competition, we're in for World War III with China. That's the course we'll be headed on. So I see that cooperation with China in the development of energy alternatives has to be the number one foreign policy priority of the next president, whoever is elected. I don't see them saying this in their campaign material, but that's the logic of the path we're on.
Professor Clare, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Michael T. Clare is Five College Professor at the Peace and World Securities Program at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. His latest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. An earlier book was Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.